This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When Branford Marsalis is busy, we all reap the rewards. The legendary saxophonist recently released a CD called Songs of Mirth and Melancholy. He also just completed production on a new quartet recording. This summer, the Ellis Marsalis Center for Music, named for his father, opened in New Orleans, and Branford's original compositions are playing on Broadway in the production of Mountaintop. That's a play starring Angela Bassett and Samuel L. Jackson. But luckily, Branford Marsalis is never too busy for North Carolina. He's called Durham home for nearly a decade now. Tomorrow, he's going to be honored with the North Carolina Award for Fine Arts, and that's the state's highest civilian honor. And it is an honor and a pleasure to welcome Branford Marsalis back to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Great to see you, Frank.
So what does this mean now? This is, you know, you've got, three Grammys, you've honored for all kinds of other things, and now the North Carolina Award for the state.
I can retire now. I have awards. I'm good.
Yeah.
The checks are just rolling.
It doesn't always translate to record sales.
It doesn't translate into much, but it's nice.
Yeah. But this is the state of North Carolina now.
No, for people this award actually has, in a lot of ways, more value than something like a Grammy. Because with the Grammys, there is a voting process, and the voting process is all record industry insiders. And a lot of times, particularly non-popular music, whether it's classical music, which is why does Sir George Schulte have 18 Grammy Awards? I mean, it's the name they recognize. Mm. So sometimes it's a name recognition contest, or you happen to be affiliated with a company, pardon me, like Columbia Records, which is one of the largest record companies in the world. So when the email comes down the chain saying, here are all our artists, vote for them, they vote for the categories they like, and then they have three or four categories left over, and they say, oh, I like that guy, and they vote for it. But this is a committee got together and decided that I wasn't too bad a guy, and that was cool. That was nice.
And not too bad an artist who has done quite a bit of work, wide range of stuff. Busy here in Durham, you recorded two music projects right down the road at the Hayti Heritage Center.
Yeah, we've been recording at the Hayti for 5 or 6 years now, maybe more than that, but definitely for the last 5 or 6 years.
You like the sound there?
Love the sound of the room. And we have a lot of equipment, so we just bring our recording equipment into the room and record. It hasn't happened very often, but the only drag is when you have a really beautiful take and suddenly a school bus rolls by and you hear it. Or the trains. The trains are always coming by. So it's like our wager. If we get a really good take, the train will come. And so far, it's only happened twice in 5 or 6 years.
Have you ever written a train song? It sounds like it's time for you to do that.
No, Wenton's written a train song. Wenton's written an entire record dedicated to trains. It was great. But no, I have not, because when the train rumbles by when we're in the middle of a ballad, I'm thinking other things. I'm not thinking of them as beautiful, wonderful. I'm thinking in a very different way.
You're hating the trains.
Pretty much.
The new CD called Songs of Mirth and Melancholy, collaboration between you and pianist Joey Calderazzo, who lives in Durham. How did you two get together?
I've known Joey since he was 14 years old. His brother, Gene Calderazzo, is a drummer, lives in London now. But at the time, Gene, Jeff Watts, me, Wallace Roney, all these guys, we were all attending the Berklee College of Music. And Gene and I lived on the same floor in the dorms. And he said, yeah, my brother's coming to town. He's going to hang out with us a little bit. And he came in, and he was a monster player even then. He played better than most of us when he was 14. So wow. You make the mental check.
File that in the back of your...
Yeah. Keep an eye on that guy.
Well, your longtime collaborator, Kenny Kirkland, passed away in 1998. And I understand that you were not thinking about replacing him. At that point, this is 98, you thought, well, there's no replacing him.
Well, I debated as to whether I was going to go trio or hire Joey. Those were the only two options, which sounds kind of crazy when you think about how many hundreds of people play jazz in New York City. Well, thousands in New York City, but hundreds of piano players. But for the style of music that we play and for the kind of, you know, anal specificity that I kind of function with, it was either going to be Joey or no Joey, but there wasn't anybody else.
So you knew you were definitely appreciated his abilities as a pianist, but it's a different style, you and Kenny. Was it a big adjustment for you? Did it change the way you came at your music?
No. When you have a new member in the band, the whole band changes. Everything changes. So it was an adjustment period for all of us. It was a big change for Joey because for lack of a better word, ideology that he had espoused in playing with other groups was very different than the one that we employ. And it took him a year to understand where we were coming from and start listening to some of the music that we'd listened to form our opinions. And years in, it was really incredible. It was actually taking on directions that it probably would not have taken with Kenny in the group.
Well, we'll put that into music right now and listen to a clip from the CD. The CD is called Songs of Mirth and Melancholy, and this is a part of a song called One Way. There's a little bit of One Way from Songs of Mirth and Melancholy, the latest from my guest Branford Marsalis, along with pianist Joey Calderazzo. So that puts it in music, what you were talking about. But when you talked about a different ideology coming at it a different way, can you put that in words for us?
Sure. I think a lot of New York jazz musicians, the parallels that I would use are more in line with pop music than with jazz. And what I mean by that is that there's this constant obsession with the perception of newness. Okay, it's good, but is it new? And our argument is there's so little that is actually good. Why don't we try good first and worry about new later? And in order to the idea of if you really play jazz and you like jazz, then maybe you should learn all of it rather than the little narrow sliver that appeals to the way you think right now. So we are really well-versed in music prior to 1950, in addition to the music from 50 on. And a lot of the modern players, 50 is about as far back as they go. And there's something that is actually missing in the sound when you use that philosophy.
Do you consciously try to bring that forward in the music, or it's just always percolating?
Don't have to.
Yeah.
We don't have to consciously try. It's like consciously trying to be American. You don't have to try. You grow up here.
Yeah.
I just played golf a couple of days ago with a guy who's from, his parents are from Sao Paulo, and we were talking about Brazil. He says, "But man, I'm American." I speak a little of the language, but I completely can't relate to being Brazilian. It's just, you don't have to try. You just do the work and it takes care of itself.
I want to get to a second clip on the CD before the break, because that was the Mirthful song that we heard. And a lot of this is melancholy.
Very.
This is a clip from the song called Hope.
Oh.
That's Hope from Songs of Mirth and Melancholy, the latest from Branford Marsalis along with Joey Calderazzo. Did this project come together for you as a piece? Was it Mirth and Melancholy, or did you have a bunch of pieces there and said, that's what those are?
Yeah, we brought in tunes.
Yeah.
We wrote some songs and brought them in, and we worked them out and played them, and then when it was all over, I don't really focus on names until well after the recording process is done, because we don't have lyrics. So the names, not only are they not as easily defined as when you have lyrics, but they're not really necessary. They're just markers. And 'cause I was at the recording session, we just did a recording with a quartet 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and a writer came in and said, how are you going to know the concepts of the songs if you don't have titles? I said, well, that's a very pop music way of looking at it. What's the concept of Beethoven's music? You're What's right. the concept of Mozart's music or Charlie Parker's? It's sound. It's negotiations and sound. And we could easily just call it song number one, song number two, and song number three.
I'm going to take a break right now and come back and talk with you about what happens when you do work with a narrative and your work on the Broadway play Mountaintop. Branford Marsalis on The State of Things. Our conversation continues from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour, saxophonist and composer Branford Marsalis. Celebrated musician is going to be honored with a North Carolina Award in Fine Arts tomorrow. That's the state's highest civilian honor. Some of Branford's latest work can be heard on Broadway. He composed original music for the play Mountaintop. It stars Angela Bassett, and Samuel L. Jackson is Martin Luther King Jr.
I heard you was preaching everybody the same. Negro folk, white folk, we all alike.
Well, at the most human level, we are all the same.
What one thing we all got in common?
We scared, Cammy. We all scared. We're scared of each other, scared of ourselves. They just scared. Scared of losing something they've known their whole lives. Fear makes us human.
The play's soundtrack is getting just as much buzz as its star power. Here's a sample of Branford's musical contribution to Mountaintop. Yeah, okay. Branford is here shaking his head, saying, that's awful. They gave you that? And that's what they gave us.
Yeah,
what do you
it's
mean,
terrible.
That's awful? You wrote that.
Okay. I was actually in New Orleans when the call came. We want you to write this music, and we need it in October. And I realized that this was going to be very different than the Fences.
You wrote, because you did the music for Fences as
yeah.
well. Right.
August Wilson's plays are uniquely Black American plays. I knew that it took place in Pittsburgh in the 50s, and yeah. I was aware of the Crawford Grill and the style of music that was played, very similar to the music that was playing in the break, Gene Ammons. And mm-hmm. so I had a template that I could work with, and I hired my students from Central, where I teach, from North Carolina Central, and yeah. we played the music. But on this one, I could tell it was written in a way that had more of a universal feel to it, and period music wasn't going to work. So I was writing the songs while I was on the road with this modern, upgraded digital equipment that I bought in New Orleans and in some other places, because I knew I was going to be traveling the whole time. So what you heard was a file that I sent to the music supervisor that they accidentally quantized. So the symbol, when you quantize symbols, is something I knew from just dealing with MIDI in the old days. It acts weird. So it wasn't actually the correct pattern on the symbol. It was a fake bass sound when the real music is a real bass player and a real drummer. And that's my brother Wenton playing trumpet there. But the trumpet part is completely off kilter from where it's supposed to be. So when I heard it, I was like, that was the nightmare temp track that they decided to try to, you know, fix some things and destroyed it. So thanks for playing that, Frank.
Well,
appreciate it.
Thanks for playing it. The next time we ask, you know, the folks who schedule this to send us some music, do you want to get involved?
No, they just grab whatever they can grab. It's right. Fine.
And it was trumpet. And you're a saxophonist. What, Winton doesn't have enough work that you have to write a trumpet piece for this?
Well, it was clear from all the various things I thought about and tried that trumpet made more sense. There's two really excellent biographies on King. One is called Parting the Waters, and the other one's called Let the Trumpet Sound. If you read a lot of his speeches, he often mentions the trumpet representing the call to action, you know, St. Peter, you know, when the trumpet sounds, and he makes that reference a lot in speeches. So it should be trumpet, and the trumpet has an aura of majesty when played correctly that no other instrument can really match it. And my brother, he's a hack, but he's pretty good.
So I called him, I said, hey,
I got a session. I'll give you $5. He went, okay, man, $5, okay.
And he showed up,
Boy, well, I wasn't there for the session. That's the great thing. I was in Seattle. And he said, this is the only day I can do it. So I called these guys. I said, Winton's going to come in. Just give him the music. And the guy calls back and said, it's the most amazing session I've ever been to. He walked in. He played it twice and left. 5 minutes. I said, well, what's wrong? He goes, no, it's just perfect. I'm shocked. Guys usually take a half an hour. He just walked in, read it, and hit it and left.
What do you think about the music? Did he call you back, say, hey, nice job, bro?
It was just one little piece of music.
Tell me about the difference again, because you said something earlier. August Wilson's plays, you say, are essentially Black American plays. This play, Mountaintop, you thought had more universal themes. And yet, certainly Wilson has universal themes, or they wouldn't be as good as they are. So what's the difference for you as a composer at these two plays in terms of how you write?
August's plays have a universal emotional appeal. The situations are not unique to Black people. Those situations are, and that's what draws people in, because he's a great storyteller. But how he delivers the story, Black colloquial language is at the center of his plays. And that's why he uses characters that understand Southern dialect, because although they are living in Pittsburgh, culturally, they are still from Mississippi, and they constantly make references to when they were in Mississippi. And Southerners, we have a flair that's just different. Katori, the way she wrote this play, there's an article that Katori Hall wrote in the New York Times about an experimental acting troupe in Moscow that called her and said, we have these two brown Russians, and we don't have a lot of material for them, and your play would be great, and we'll translate the play. And she went to Russia to study acting and playwriting. So she had experiences there. Some were good, some were not so good. So she just recalled her experiences and talked about how the Russians got the play. And I guess the best way to put it is that you can take Katori's play, translated into Russian, and everybody gets it. I would love to see them try to translate an August Wilson play into another language.
The cadences are just not going to come across, right?
Some of the words, they don't even... Yeah. It's like, you know, it would be very, very difficult, I think. And that's all I really mean by it. It's not like one is better than the other. It's just when I saw Fences the first time, when I saw the piano lesson, when I read the plays, it was clear that the music in the piano lesson, because the piano lesson is basically a Mississippi play. So I know what that is. That's Delta blues. Fences is Pittsburgh in the 50s. So it's jump blues, swing bands, soulful stuff. With this particular play, Martin Luther King is a universal character. And even though I don't want to spoil the play for people. So
Plot summary.
Well, I actually can't, because it doesn't really spoil anything. It's Martin's last day on Earth, which he doesn't know at the time. He's in the Lorraine Motel, and there is a very attractive maid/room service person that comes in, and they talk and play and fight and argue, And eventually it is revealed to him that she was sent by God as an angel, and she's supposed to guide him to the other side because this is his last night on earth. So the themes are really universal, and how she sees the world and how she writes, it's really, really great the way she writes.
Did you have to think more about the themes? It sounds to me like in those other projects, you got to evoke a period. You're trying. That's what you're doing mostly. And cadences, rhythms. In this play, did you have to think more about the themes? Did you have to do more research on Martin
Luther King? Well, I thought about the themes. I thought about the themes in Fences as well. But the template is very different because I'm starting with it's naked, it's nothing. Because it's not the play is really not about Martin Luther King. That's the thing that's really interesting is that, yeah, Martin Luther King is the character, but it's not really about Martin. So studying Dr. King's work really wasn't going to help me. But seeing Samuel and Angela interact with one another. And what I try to do is I try to get to whatever the emotional template of the piece is, which is the same thing that I do in music. Don't bore me with the details, with the chord structures and all of that, because when a song is well written, it reveals to you what it requires emotionally, and it's my job to use sound to create that emotion. So that was the biggest problem was, how do I write something that can have a sense of majesty and a sense of dread at the same time? And I knew I wanted to write it for Wynton, so I started thinking, what are chamber pieces that have trumpet features, beautiful melodies? And I settled in on Aaron Copland's Quiet City, which is a piece he wrote with a feature for English horn and trumpet. And I listened to it multiple times a day. Excuse me. Multiple times a day. And after about 2 weeks of listening, this melody started to come to me. And it was a melody that really didn't need, which is one of those great things in Quiet City, the trumpet plays without, for lack of a better term, accompaniment for a large part of it in the beginning. And it needed to be a melody that could stand alone on its own. And in the end, we added a really low drone, a single note drone, to create that sense of foreboding. And the tech guys on the play interspersed snippets of the famous mountaintop speech at times. It's dramatic.
When you talked about listening to Aaron Copland's piece and then your original melody emerges, so that doesn't interfere. I mean, I would think that you'd almost be scared to do that, or a composer would say, no, don't mess with my head. I don't want to be pushed in one direction or another.
Well, I believe in research.
Yeah.
And I don't believe in I believe the obsession with newness is an illusion, because if you take almost anything that's ever been written with the Western scale, there's only 12 notes. So in the past 1,000 years, that sequence of notes has already been played.
Right.
So what makes the music unique is the sound of it, the delivery of it, the timing, and the musician's ability to create a personal sound. And those are things that can't be bought and can't be controlled. But I've never been a person who believed that spending your life trying to learn from people who are better than you makes you an imitator.
Yeah, no, that shows, I think, amazing courage to say, I know I'm going to come up with something that is going to be original, and yet, at the same time, almost nothing is original.
I didn't know. I just had faith that it would work.
Faith that it would work.
And fortunately for me, it did.
You talked about Fences, now Mountaintop. August Wilson, of course, had a great run on Wall Street with his work. Are theater audiences demanding a return of African-American narratives on the Great White Way?
I think that
did I say Wall Street?
Yeah,
I said Wall Street.
Yeah, but I knew what you meant.
Yeah,
you meant Broadway. It's right. Fine.
Same city.
Yeah, same city. Just a couple of miles difference. I think that as long as the play is good, then it doesn't matter. I think that we're kind of in this place as a culture, as a people. Where the color is no longer the primary thing you see. So now black performers don't just have to sing in musicals. Like, it's been a long time since you've seen those old, you know, vaudeville / charlatan type plays that predominated in the late 60s all the way up to the 90s. It is no longer a requirement.
But we're still interested in a narrative of a particular people in a particular
context. As long as it has a universal theme. It's just the idea that there used to be this idea that blacks were others, and they had this subculture that was at best different and unique, at worst devious. And that permeated my childhood growing up. And now we are, as a nation, in a place where that's no longer concerned to theatergoers. So I don't think that they feel an absence when they don't see black characters. I don't think that there's a need to see brown people. I think that there's just a desire to witness a well-acted story regardless of what the people look like.
One of the tunes on your new CD, Songs of Mirth and Melancholy, was inspired by another work of African-American fiction. Tell us about the song Precious.
Oh, Precious. Wow. Nobody's ever asked me that. Yeah, the movie, was it 2 years ago?
Yeah.
My wife and I went to the movie, and when it was over, I just couldn't leave. I couldn't leave the seat. I just sat there crying for about 15 minutes. For myriad reasons, not just because of the stuff you see on the screen. It was this kind of reality of the damage that poverty does to people. How that story could be, it's very similar to, there was a movie that was about a young woman who was about to lose her house in it was dealing with meth labs in Missouri. It was a movie that came out, and I felt the same way when that was over. It's just, you look at the damage that poverty does to people and how it takes the exceptional character to rise above it, and how when her mother was heaping unimaginable levels of cruelty on her, her mother was actually the victim, and she somehow had that intestinal fortitude to just say, I am not going to be like you. And it's a shame that even in our country, it takes that. It's like the exceptional person gets out, and the people who aren't super strong in character just get trapped and repeat the same foolishness that was done to them. And so I came home, and my in-laws were in town, so Nicole and the kids, she went with them because I was just destroyed. I was useless. And when I got back to the house, I just picked up my tenor saxophone and started writing this tune, and it wrote itself in about 5 minutes.
Let's hear some of it right now. Precious. That's a little bit of Precious from Branford Marsalis' new CD, Songs of Mirth and Melancholy. When you finish writing a song like that, Branford, does that take you to a new place? Do you relive that moment in the theater when Precious ended, or do you find yourself at a new?
No, it takes on a life of its own. I know what the emotional template is. So you when we're recording, I'm not really thinking about the movie at that point. It's just about how fine the line is between hope and hopelessness. And that's the song, is it's hope and hopelessness. It's not hope or hopelessness. So you try to create a sound that kind of touches both sides of it.
And it allows you to feel that tension as you're walking that line. We talked about recording at the Hayti Heritage Center here in Durham, but future projects, maybe the Ellis Marsalis Center for Music in New Orleans.
Yeah, it's looking that way.
Tell us about that.
When Harry Connick and I, your buddy Harry, sends his regards.
Say hi to Harry for me, and hail to the goats.
Hail to the goat, baby. I'm not telling you, have to explain that. So when Harry and I started talking about using his affiliation with Habitat for Humanity to start building homes to help musicians. The response from people was so incredible that we had a lot of money left over. And we said, why not build an education center? And that took on a life of its own, because then suddenly that money was gone and we had to raise more to finish the education center. But it's a state-of-the-art performance facility with recording capabilities, classrooms, meeting rooms, and it's the centerpiece of the Musician's Village. And we're leaning that way.
We'll let you go down there and record now and then, but you got to come back.
I'm not leaving. I'm here.
Branford Marsalis, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Frank.
Branford Marsalis will receive tomorrow the North Carolina Award in the Arts, as we said, state's highest civilian honor. New CD is called Songs of Mirth and Melancholy. You can find out more at marsalismusic.com. Coming up after a short break, a new book takes us down the Haw River with a look at the history of the river and efforts to protect it. Stay with us. Thank you.